Her work has focused on the prevention of injuries related to motor vehicle crashes, falls, and physical training, and has ranged from field investigations of injury risk factors in the Army to evaluations of injury prevention programs to the use of surveillance data in setting DOD prevention and policy priorities. So, Dr. Trebek.
That just means I'm a jack of all trades where we are, which a lot of times we're required to be. But today I'll be telling you about some program evaluations that we were involved in actually three injury prevention program evaluations. So I'd like to thank my co-authors, Mr. Tyson Greer, who was the co-lead on this with me, who's an exercise physiologist, Ms. Esther Dada, and Dr. Bruce Jones, who is our program manager. So I have no financial relationships to disclose, and I have the same disclaimer where the views expressed in this presentation are my views and don't necessarily reflect official policy. So our population was an infantry division. It consisted of four brigades. One of them was already deployed. Three were getting prepared to deploy. And the division surgeon of this division contacted us with some concerns. She had seen among her non-deployable population that 69% were non-deployable due to medical reasons. She also had seen that of those who were medically not ready to deploy, that about half of them, 45%, were due to musculoskeletal injuries. She also felt that the current physical training programs were resulting in injury and that injured soldiers were not given enough time to recondition and rehab appropriately, so she was asking us to look at these factors. As in other Army units, brigades established their own physical training programs, and I'll show you in a minute that they all vary. Each commander puts their individual touch on the program, and so evaluations of each program were desired. This work was very important for us because it was one of our first looks at an operational Army unit, so soldiers that have made the Army their career. Much of the injury risk factor work previously had been done in basic training, which is a very controlled environment, so we are excited to have this opportunity. So our objectives with these evaluations was to look at the effect of the physical training programs on injury and fitness. We had a number of outcomes that we were looking at, so injury rates, changes in physical fitness, and also to look at, as a surrogate for the amount of time they were allowed to recondition and rehab, the limited duty days that were assigned to them when they saw a medical provider. So our data sources included unit rosters, which allowed us to establish our population at the beginning and the end of the program. We had electronic Army physical fitness test records that were available from the units. So the Army physical fitness test, or the APFT, consists of the 2-mile run for time, a 2-minute timed push-up test, number of repetitions that can be done in 2 minutes, as well as a sit-up test, number of sit-ups that can be completed in 2 minutes. We had surveys both before and after program implementation that gave us information on physical training activities, injuries, and injury risk factors, such as tobacco use. We had medical encounter data from the Defense Medical Surveillance System. And you may ask why we collect both survey and medical encounter data. In some instances, survey data is necessary when they're in the field environment and they can't access fixed medical facilities. So often our choice is to collect both, really, in case we need to rely on the self-report as opposed to the electronic surveillance data. In some cases, we had supplemental data on physical fitness testing. And we also had manuals and other materials that explain the programs to us. So in the first program, which was called the Iron Horse Performance Optimization Program, they all have very fancy names, you'll see. it was based on Army doctrine. So the Army doctrine for physical training is the Army Physical Readiness Training Manual, FM7-22. And in it is described a whole series of exercises from agility and mobility training to strength training. It also has a section on reconditioning and appropriate reconditioning during injury. So it's really a wide variety of programs. This program also included the implementation of a musculoskeletal action team, which consisted of a physical therapist, a physical therapy assistant, both of whom were uniformed, and then contract 2 athletic trainers and 2 certified strength and conditioning coaches. So all of these folks together were working with the unit. They were assigned to the unit to provide medical care, which was primarily the focus of the physical therapy staff. But also they would go out to the unit, the athletic trainers and the strength and conditioning coaches, to supervise and assist with applying the training manual appropriately. So we had an initial survey, and about 6 months later had a follow-up survey. This was all driven by deployment schedules. The unit deployed in May, so we had limited time with them. The 2nd Brigade had their Tactical Athlete Program, TAP. Everyone wants a fancy acronym, too. This program was very similar in that it was based on the Army Doctrine, the FM7-22, but they tagged on a little extra piece, which was Olympic weightlifting components. So they had a gymnasium where they had received funding to get barbells and heavy weights and do, and their conditioning and strength coaches would supervise the weightlifting there. They again had a musculoskeletal action team. Unlike the first group that had their physical therapy staff based at the hospital, which was some distance from the unit, they were able to obtain some space on the unit footprint that allowed better access to care. So they too would work both on the injury prevention side with helping them implement the physical training program appropriately to avoid injury, but also in the care side and provide some better access to care. This group did not deploy, so we had an initial survey followed up 1 year later with a follow-up survey. And with the 3rd group, they called their program the Mountain Athlete Warrior Program. This one was very different. We were very curious because of the influx of extreme conditioning programs into Army programs. So this one had elements of extreme conditioning programs. They brought in some folks to train them on extreme conditioning, as well as Olympic weightlifting and strength training. About 300 soldiers, their exercise leaders, received this training. They did not have the musculoskeletal action team. So their timeline, we had an initial survey, and then about 8 months later, we had a follow-up survey prior to their deployment. So over the course of all this, we collected over 18,000 surveys. The unit shared almost 15,000 data points on fitness assessments. It was a lot of information, bottom line. So getting into our results, the first program, the Iron Horse Performance Optimization, that had the musculoskeletal action team at the hospital, saw no change in injury rates. You can see here, 56 to 57 per 1,000 soldiers per month were injured during the time the program was before and then after program implementation. With the Tactical Athlete Program, we looked at them over a year again. So if you look at their initial injury rate and the final injury rate after a year, not different. However, we realized there were some changes that occurred in this unit, as is what happens in many Army units. Their leadership was asked to deploy in the middle of this year. So all of the leaders and the exercise leaders that had been trained deployed. The result was no change in injury risk. If we look 6 months into the program, which is this first number here, there had been a decline in injury rates during initial implementation of the program. With the Mountain Athlete Warrior, this was our one that had extreme conditioning program elements, we saw no change in injury risk. This unit, we relied on the self-reported injury data as opposed to the medical encounter data because they had a field training during the midst of the evaluation period. So looking at the limited duty days that were assigned to soldiers in all of these programs. So with the first, we saw a slight increase in the number of limited duty days assigned over time. With the second, the unit-based musculoskeletal action team, we saw a doubling of the limited duty days over time. And in a sense, this was what we wanted to see. We wanted to see better access to care. We wanted to see soldiers getting more time to recuperate from their injuries. With the Mountain Athlete Warrior, the extreme conditioning program, we saw a decrease in the number of limited duty days that soldiers were able to obtain for their injuries. Looking at the types of injuries and the body location and the causes, surprisingly to us, They were relatively very similar, so sprains and strains and pain showed up in the top three of all of each of these programs, each of the injuries reported by the soldiers. Lower extremity was the most common, which is what we typically see. And the leading cause in all of these units was running, which is also what we typically see. So looking at the fitness outcomes, we used matched men only, and these are the Army physical fitness test results. So we have the 2 mile run for time, the push-ups for in 2 minutes, and sit-ups in 2 minutes. Looking at the first program, we saw actually slower run times over the course of the program, slightly more push-ups, slightly more sit-ups, with the overall test score, which the maximum amount of points is 300, we saw a slight increase. Looking at the second program that had the unit-based musculoskeletal action team, we saw, again, a slower run time, no change in push-ups, and a slight change in sit-ups, and slight change in the total score. With the program that had the extreme conditioning elements, we saw improvements in run time by 24 seconds, slight changes in push-ups and sit-ups, and an overall improvement in scores. What was most interesting to us, though, was that ultimately all of these programs had approximately very, very similar final scores for their Army physical fitness test. So really there wasn't one program that outshined the other with regard to fitness improvements. So our survey allowed us to capture data on the physical training activities that the units were undertaking. So we have in the red, before program implementation, what the soldiers reported with regard to the number of units running more than 10 miles per week, if they were conducting cross-training more than one time per week, resistance training more than one time per week, and agility drills more than one time per week. So all of these are things that we would like to see them getting toward, except for the run is what we would like to see them reducing. These other things are what we'd like to see them implementing. So with regard to the first program that had the musculoskeletal action team that would go out and assist in the mornings with physical training, we saw reductions in running, some increases in cross-training, resistance training, and agility drills. With the unit that over time lost their soldiers that had been trained in the fitness program, we saw an increase in run and little change with cross-training agility, some improvements in resistance training. And basically what they helped us figure out was that the fitness leaders that had been trained moved on. Those that had to move up and take their place were reverting back to what they knew, which was really to train for the test, which was the running and the sit-ups and the push-ups. And that is what we unfortunately see very often with these programs. With the program that had the extreme conditioning elements, we saw a decrease in run, some reported increase in cross-training, a larger increase in resistance training, and agility drills over time. I mentioned that we had access to some additional fitness tests. I'm not showing it here, but there weren't any changes in any of these tests. There were a wide variety, as you can see, tests for power, tests for agility, tests for mobility, tests for balance. We did also look at, because we were interested in whether or not these tests were associated with injury ultimately, and found that some of these were. And so these are tests that we are considering, the folks that are helping us design a revamped Army physical fitness test are considering for possible alternatives to the current. So in summary, so our results suggested that no program really outshone another. There were no significant increases or decreases in injury or fitness. The one program that instituted some extreme conditioning program we had thought might show really high injury rates. It didn't. The unit-based musculoskeletal action team appears to have increased access to care, and soldiers seem to be getting more time to rehab, as indicated by the increase in limited duty days. Unfortunately, we weren't with that unit for long enough to really assess whether or not they were getting fewer recurrent injuries. And finally, all of the programs saw increases in the cross-training, resistance training, and agility drills, which we were hoping to see with increased focus on the Army doctrine, as well as even the extreme conditioning programs, really kind of gets them away from the running, which is producing the overuse injuries. So in support of the goal of this panel, some advantages and challenges to what we've done with these evaluations, and Dr. Jackson mentioned some of these. But we benefit from the administrative and medical surveillance data that is available. We benefit from the command support that allows us to get good survey responses. Our survey responses are often up to between 60 and 80%. We have unit staff that assist with the survey distribution, and they do so very methodically. and also we have the additional data that's available to us. So challenges, as I've mentioned, sometimes our data collection is affected by long-term training or deployment. Timeframes for implementation of these programs were much shorter than what the commanders had hoped for in at least two out of the three cases. There's also movement in and out of the unit that we have to track, but are fortunately able to with the assistance by the unit. There's some incomplete documentation of implementation. I feel that's a place we could probably gain from some qualitative data collection processes. The finding appropriate comparison groups can be a challenge because every unit is different. Every unit has a different mission, different geographic placement, and typically we find ourselves comparing either to all Army or a similar unit, as we've done in this case. And then, as Dr. Jackson had mentioned, a lot of these programs are being put in place, and we're coming in basically as exactly when they're being put in place. A lot of times we don't have a lot of warning. So things like randomization are typically not an option. The commander would like to implement that program and do it right then. So with that, I will take any questions. Well, that's an issue that the Army has been working very hard on. Right now, I don't know current information. Originally, it was, oh gosh, I'm trying to think what the percentages were.
We do know, the one thing that we do know is that of people who are not able to deploy, the largest factor contributing to non-deployability is medical readiness issues. Yep. So.
Of overall, it used to be about 30%. It's gotten better now. I think it's more, and it depends if you're talking about guard or active duty or reserve. So, in each of these units, the average age is about 27 or so in each of them. Yeah, there's not very much difference in that. Yes.
I have a rather unique role evaluating medical evidence for the Integrated Disability Evaluation System.
Okay.
And while I don't know what percentage are considered non-deployable, I can tell you that a lot of the folks deployed in 2007 and 2008 are now coming through the disability evaluation process. And over again, I'm looking at these pre-deployment evaluations along with other information that was readily available at the time of deployment. And I'm thinking, what were these commanders thinking? To send this person into deployment, because there is an absolutely direct relationship between the deployment that was decided on in 07 and 08 and the career-ending disabilities that I'm looking at now. Mm-hmm. So for at least sometimes, the operational needs have resulted in people classified as deployable when retrospectively they shouldn't have been.
Yeah.
It's a big deal, and it probably ought to be a bigger deal.
Yeah.
Time for another comment.
Oh, absolutely. We can take
sure.
This question, and then we can.
I'm kind of wondering about your sampling for this study and how much of the effect of the training programs might be
Yeah.
Which are traditionally the most, at least among the most physically fit and physically active.
There's actually a good mix in the infantry division.
Is there
the infantry folks themselves tend to be physically fit, but you have 2/3 of that division that's support.
Right. But when you're looking at the pre and post test.
Yes.
You don't see test scores typically on average that high. So I'm kind of curious how your results might look in a different.
Yeah, well, that's actually a good point. I hadn't thought to look at the individual, like infantry versus support. It would be a good way for us to look at the data a different way. Did you have another?
Yeah, a second thing is that looking back into a veteran's claims file, which includes a whole lot of information from the DOD medical records, with the career-ending musculoskeletal injuries that I see a whole lot of soldier has musculoskeletal injury and here's the medical care I gave for it. I see a whole lot of soldier smokes that they were counseled not to smoke and given all the assistance. But I have not seen, to my recollection, a single note in which the two phenomena of injury, musculoskeletal injury, and smoking are tied together. And while that doesn't affect my work in the disability evaluation process, because if it would have been service connected without the smoking, it's going to wind up service connected with the smoking. But I'm looking at that and saying, what a missed opportunity to keep
well, I can,
deployment
just from,
ready if they'd only been told, if you don't want to be midboarded out of here before your 20 years are up, you need to stop smoking now.
And, well, it's interesting, some of
the
evaluation work I participated with Teresa in the focus groups, I had soldiers say to me, oh, I didn't know that smoking affected wound healing. You know, so, yeah, it's a message that still really does need to get out there, and Essie can help us do that, our health communications expert. But there was another point I was going to make about, I lost my thought. I'm sorry. It'll come back to me. Yes. And the point that I wanted to make was also just anecdotally working with physical therapists like I do. Many of them constantly counsel that. But, again, there's other factors that are weighing against the quitting.
I'm seeing a biased sample. I'm seeing the ones who ultimately wound up discharged.
Right.
It would be nice if I thought there were a lot of folks doing it right, connecting the two, and their people just don't get discharged. That would be real nice.